yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a-screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, as promised last week, we're continuing our review of global economies here at year-end 2014. And today, as I indicated last week, I want to talk about the global trends. What are the critical global economic trends? You know, if we look at the global economy, what we see is everything slowing down everywhere. Europe, of course, is either stagnant, if you believe their official statistics, actually probably slightly negative. In other words, the Eurozone has slipped back into a recession. Japan has its fourth recession it's experiencing right now. Emerging markets, one after one, are tumbling into a recession all around the world. I'm talking about the majors, you know, in Latin America and Asia and other places. And China's growth is slowing to less than half of what it was at its peak a few years ago, undoubtedly less than 7% at the moment, and continuing to slow. And other pressures are beginning to grow in China, particularly debt issues and defaults and so forth. So China is in trouble, not as serious as Europe or Japan, but everywhere the global economy is slowing. And here in the United States, you know, you get this spin machine going and all this hype going about, oh, you know, the U.S. economy is different and it's really on a solid recovery path, and we've got all these jobs being created. Okay, let's look at this a little bit. We're going to come back in future week here when all the data for the year end for the U.S. Comes in and look at what's really going on. But the big emphasis here is on this so-called third quarter GDP of 5%. Wow, 5%. Isn't that magnificent? Well, you know, that used to be a typical 5% growth rate in recoveries from recessions. If you look at the big recession in the 1970s and 1980s, 5% growth rate for consecutive multiple quarters was the rule. That was the normal growth rate at this particular point in time, 5 years after the so-called end of a recession. But if you look at our growth rate this year, you know, it's not really 5%. It's going to be less than 2.5%, which is not too far from the average of 1.8% for the last 5 years. Now, that 1.8% average is about half of what has been normal during a five-year period of recovery. It's about half. So the U.S. recovery is half a recovery. And most of the benefits are accruing to the very high-end, wealthiest households. So it's even worse than half for the rest of us. Yes, 3-4% is the average over a five-year period, but ours is only 1.8%. Okay, this year, it looks like we're coming in with somewhere between 2 and 2.5%, a little bit higher. So why is it even a little bit higher? Well, because in the third quarter of last year, we had some very special one-off kinds of developments that boosted the GDP of the U.S. to that 5% figure. What were they? Well, first of all, it was a big surge in government spending. Military spending went up, added 0.7% to that 5%. In other words, if we didn't have that boost in military spending, it would have been a 4.3% third quarter growth. Not a 5%. Okay, so let's put that aside. But, you know, that's very typical. Right before elections, governments hold back their spending and then put it all into the pot in the third quarter, right before an election. You know, every national election in 4 years, every midterm election 2 years, we see that happening. Just go back and look at the data. Big surge, because then they're able to say in October, oh, well, look, you know, the economy's really growing. Elect me again. All right, so it's very typical. It happened in 2012, happened in 2010. That's typical of what goes on. That's a one-off kind of thing that you got to take out of the equation because it's not really indicating sustained economic growth. All right, so what else happened in the third quarter of this year to boost that recovery to 5%? You look at net exports. In other words, the differences between exports and imports. And if you look at that, what happened in the third quarter is that we got a jump in exports, net exports, as we call it. It's not just exports. It's the difference between the value of all the exports and the value of the imports, because you see we subtract the value of imports from the exports to get net exports, and it's net exports that adds to GDP. A little complicated, but just think of it this way, that if our import numbers drop, if the value of the imports drop, even if exports from the U.S. do not rise, net exports rise, because net exports is, again, the difference between exports and imports. So you can have a drop in your imports, and that would increase your net exports and therefore GDP. So what did we have in the third quarter? We had a big drop in the cost of oil imports. Yes, starting last June, what happened is the global oil deflation began. And it's still going on. It's a big factor that's going to cause a lot of disruption, as we've pointed out before, to the global economy, already is, and to the U.S. economy. So we get this decline in the value of U.S. imports because the price of oil imports have declined, crude oil. Therefore, we get a boost in the difference between exports, imports, i.e. net exports, which means we have a boost to GDP. Because of that, it doesn't really represent any increase in real economic activity in the U.S. It's a price adjustment having to do with the value of imports. Okay, so if you back out that, you know, you got another 0.8% of that 5%. So 0.7% excessive government spending on military, 0.8% of the 5% one-time one-off net exports. So we're really at 3.5% growth in the third quarter of this year. If we back that out into 3.5% growth, we wouldn't be averaging 2.5% for the year. We'd be averaging even less, closer to 2%. Because you see, in the first quarter, we dropped. First quarter of last year, we had this big plunge into negative GDP, almost into a recession. The third time this has happened since 2009, I call these one quarter negative GDP numbers relapses, you know, like mini recessions. And that's been characteristic of the U.S. economy for the last 5 years of this so-called recovery. We've had repeated relapses. And if you really look at how we estimate GDP, real GDP, we obviously reduce nominal, what's called nominal price GDP, by inflation to get real GDP. But we do that very conservatively. In other words, we underestimate inflation so that we can overestimate real GDP. If we really properly estimated inflation, we would have less real GDP. So, you know, if we have done the inflation adjustment correctly, we would have had one, maybe two double-dip recessions, one in 2009 and one at the beginning of this year, in the last 5 years in the U.S. Okay, well, you know, that's speculative. We can argue that particular point. But because of that, the way we calculate GDP, and because of these one-off developments, like every 2 years we boost military spending a little bit, and because of the U.S. dollar was low, we stimulated exports, or because of the oil price deflation going on, it gives us an artificial boost in net exports. So these are one-off developments. These aren't really indicative of real fundamental growth, which means the economy then slows down once again, or the growth rate slows, after we get these little spikes from quarter to quarter, usually in the third quarter of a year, for reasons I just explained. Of course, the fourth quarter GDP is going to come in lower than the 5%. We don't know exactly what, but I would think it's closer to 2%. In other words, we're looking at the same long-term average growth of about 1.8 to 2.2% in the U.S. now for 5 years in a row, a growth rate which is half of what normal recoveries from recessions are. So where's all the hoopla about U.S. economic growth? I don't know where it is. And, of course, there's other factors why we've got a little higher growth last year. What are they besides the ones I indicated, and are they going to be one-off as well? Well, one is that we've had this big surge in Obamacare spending. People have signed up for Obamacare who had nothing before, and they're paying a lot more for it. Deductibles, big-time deductibles occur with most of these plans. So people have to pay out of pocket. And because they didn't have insurance, now they have something. Now they're going and taking advantage of medical services, so they're spending more. ACA, Obamacare, has boosted health care spending. And that has been reflected in GDP in this past year. But that's a one-time deal, too, because those who have signed up have signed up, and that's it. It doesn't look like there's going to be more than 9 million or so. We were told it'd be 30 million, but doesn't look like it. And, of course, healthcare spending has gone up significantly. The cost of healthcare, as the previously uninsured now are taking advantage of it and paying higher premiums. And also paying more out-of-pocket as a result. Also, we had the shale revolution, shale oil fracking revolution in the U.S., which has raised industrial production earlier in the year. Now, of course, that industrial production is declining rapidly as the global oil price deflation occurs. It is resulting in shutting down a lot of these shale wells across the country and reducing, therefore, the mining contribution to GDP. So that's a one-off of last year that's coming, that's declining. ACA spending, that's a one-off that's declining. And then I talked about net exports, and I talked about government military spending. And then I would add auto spending. Yes, we had a big boom in auto spending last year. Because the auto companies, a lot of competition, they're offering deep discounts. Now, we don't have a real growth in real income for most folks who are buying autos. They're buying it on credit. The auto loan industry is booming, and it's much like the subprime mortgage industry. The government's even beginning to look into this. What's going on with all these auto loans? Well, they are subprime auto loans. That's what's going on, and it's a huge number of people borrowing, subprime borrowing, to buy automobiles. And that can't go on forever either. That's not sustainable either. And so the auto boom, based on credit, has given a little bit of a push. And people are buying more on credit cards as well. So all of these factors, if you look at them and put them together, the U.S. growth rate is not 5%. It's still more or less bumping along the bottom, spiking up and down, as it has for 5 years, and it's around 2% or less on a long-term average, which is about half of what is normal. So where's all the hoopla? Well, if you look behind the surface and below, It's just not there. And this is occurring at a time that the global economy is slowing. All right. What I've just described to you is one of the major characteristics of the global economy, a slowdown everywhere occurring. Even if, you know, you get behind all the spin machine in the U.S., which is, you know, very powerful spin machine, misrepresentation of the facts. They want you to believe these things even though they're not true. So that's a major development. What else can we talk about as major trends to watch? Well, another major trend is disinflation and deflation. Well, what's the difference, disinflation and deflation from inflation? Well, inflation, of course, is rising prices. Disinflation means that the rate of growth of price increases is slowing. In other words, instead of growing at 3%, it's growing at 2% or 1%. That's disinflation. Deflation is when prices actually decline, go negative. Well, we just passed into the realm of deflation in Europe. Europe is deflating. In the U.S., price increases are slowing over the last several years. Very clear. We're not at deflation yet, negative, but we are slowing down and approaching that. And the rest of the world, we see this drift towards deflation as well. Now, why is deflation important? It's because once you get into negative territory in terms of prices, it starts to freeze up both investment and consumer spending. Well, how could that be? You would think that, well, wait a minute, lower prices mean you get to keep more money. If you've got more money, you will then spend it. If you're a business, you'll spend it on investment. If you're a consumer, you'll spend it on consumption. That's the argument, particularly of conservatives and pro-business folks. Oh, it's good. Lower prices are good. Well, flip that over. If prices are falling, let's take the example of a consumer, I'm going to wait until they fall still further. Well, for example, when we had the housing price crash here, did people jump right in as soon as prices started falling? No, they waited until they fell further. You know, why buy something at X amount when tomorrow or the next day you could buy it at an even lesser amount? Well, let's just watch the deflation and let's see if we can time the bottom, and then we'll jump in and buy that car or buy that house. You see, prices only start rising and people start buying when it's clear that it's bottomed out. We've seen that with the housing industry, for example. Well, the same thing happens on the employer side. If I'm an employer, yes, maybe the cost of my materials and input are declining, but, you know, what about the price of my products when I bring them to market? Will they be declining too? Well, I don't want to go through all the trouble of investing and building more products or new products today with the intent of bringing them to market 6 months from now if the price 6 months from now is going to be less than I think it is today. I'm uncertain whether I can sell those products and cover my costs. So you know what? I'm not going to make them. I'm not going to invest. I like to invest, i.e. a business person, if I think that prices will be higher tomorrow than they are today, 6 months down the road today. That's the ideal. That's when I want to invest. But it doesn't look like that. If prices are slowing, then and they're only, less than 2%, well, gee, I'm going to hold off. I'm uncertain. I'm going to wait and see. So deflation puts a damper on both business investment and consumer big-ticket purchases. And Europe has entered that realm very clearly. And the U.S. is drifting towards that realm, as is most of the rest of the world economy, in some cases already in deflation and others in disinflation. All right, so that's another important trend. Third trend of importance here, growing debt. Debt. Oh, okay. What are we talking about? Well, we can talk about government debt. We can talk about business private debt, and we can talk about household consumer debt. And if you look at all categories, they've all been rising in recent years and continue to rise. Well, wait a minute. You know, everyone says that we've been working off that debt, right? Well, the top 10% households have worked off a lot of their debt and refinanced and so forth. But, you know, the vast majority of consumers are still languishing under rising debt. Auto debt has been rising significantly. Student debt is rising. Credit card debt, you're not rising as fast, but nonetheless still rising. What about business? Well, business debt has been rising even faster. What are the forms of business debt? Issuing of corporate bonds, for example, are a form of debt. Issuing corporate short-term commercial paper are a form of corporate debt. Borrowing from banks, loans, industrial commercial loans, that's a form of corporate debt. And if you look at it, debt is rising rapidly across the spectrum. Let's take the U.S. case. Let's take the riskiest kind of debt, what's called high-yield corporate debt or junk bonds, you see. Junk bonds. In the last 5 years, junk bonds have exploded. They've issued almost $2 trillion just in the U.S. alone, another trillion in Europe, who knows how much in Asia, of high-yield, high-risk junk bonds. Now, that compares to, you know, just a couple hundred billion in the 5 years prior to that. So we go from, you know, less than $500 billion accumulated over 5 years in high-yield junk bond debt in the U.S. to almost $2 trillion of additional new high-yield corporate debt. And in fact, high-yield debt, junk bond debt, is not the whole picture of corporate debt. There's what's called investment-grade corporate bonds as well. They haven't risen as rapidly as the high-yield risky debt, but they have risen significantly as well as companies like Apple and others go out and borrow. In other words, they issue corporate bonds, and then they take that money from their corporate bonds and they distribute it to their shareholders. Apple has distributed something like $50 billion to its shareholders, $30 billion of which it borrowed in the corporate debt market, the bond market, and then distributed. Well, why would a company take on debt in order to distribute it to its shareholders? You know, Apple is sitting on $100 billion in cash. Why wouldn't it use some of that? Well, because a lot of that $100 billion is sitting in its offshore subsidiaries. And if it brought that $100 billion back, or part of it, to give to its shareholders, it would have to pay Uncle Sam taxes. You see, these big companies keep their cash offshore so they don't have to pay taxes. And what they do then is borrow at very, very low rates, corporate debt, investment-grade debt, bonds, and distribute that money to placate their shareholders. But they're taking on more debt in the process. Now, what's the problem with debt? Well, in times of booming, you know, there is no problem with debt. You know, you issue the money, the bonds, you get the money, you spend it like you like. But, you know, you always have to pay principal and interest on debt. And what happens if the economy slows down or you're in another recession? Well, then your income flow to service your principal and interest on your bond debt declines. Oh, well, you know, whoever loaned you the money or whoever bought your bonds doesn't care. You got to pay them. So you have less income to service the debt. And what are your choices then? Let's say I'm a smaller company. Let's say I'm an oil shale drilling company. If I'm an oil shale drilling company, I've been borrowing heavily in the junk bond market. And now what's happening is the price of oil and gas, shale gas included, globally, is declining. So I have to shut down some of my wells because they're unprofitable. Well, if I shut down my wells, that means I have less income. That means I have less resources to pay this huge junk bond debt I borrowed to drill wells over the last 5 years. If it gets to a point that I don't have enough income to pay, well, then what do I got to do? I got to go back and borrow some more, now at higher prices. And maybe if I'm in such a bad shape, I can't even borrow. People won't even buy my new bonds, or banks won't give me new loans because they know I'm on shaky economic ground. I may not survive, and that means default. I can't get loans to roll over my debt because I look too risky. Therefore, I have to go out of business. Oh, too much debt is dangerous. Not during good times, but when the bad times come and you don't have the income and revenue flow to pay the interest and principal on that debt, then you're in deep doo-doo. That's what's happening already in the shale regions, the shale drilling regions, oil and gas drilling regions of the country. You know, North Dakota, Texas, Pennsylvania, and so forth. The shale boom is over. Now, the shale boom, by the way, added a lot to GDP last year. And that's another factor that's not going to be there in 2015, just as like these other one-off factors I talked about can't be counted on to ensure sustained U.S. GDP economic growth going forward. Okay, that's debt, a big trend. Deflation, a big trend. Slowing real growth, big trend. Another trend is a long-term slowdown in real investment going on globally, including the U.S. Now, what do we mean real investment? Real investment is business investment in real physical assets, plant, equipment, buildings, software, you know, manufacturing and so forth. That's what we mean when we say real asset investment, real investment, as opposed to financial asset investment. In other words, investing in derivatives, investing in bonds and real estate and things like that. Now, it's a fact that many large companies, multinational companies, U.S. and elsewhere, are turning increasingly towards investing in financial assets. This is called portfolio investment. Typical large multinational corporation generates at least a fourth of its total revenues from this kind of portfolio financial asset investment. And that's a big trend. Why? Because financial asset investment is more profitable. I can get in and out of these financial markets immediately. I can play price appreciation games here and jump in and jump out, you know, which is less risky for me than investing in long-term product development, where I got to get suppliers and I got to get a sales force to push this and so forth, and I got competition and I don't know what's going to happen. A lot of uncertainty in real goods and services investment, much more short-term and much more profitable to jump in and out of these financial asset markets, you know, engage in interest rate swap, derivative plays, and so forth. All right, my thesis is that as this financial asset investment becomes more lucrative and companies drift towards it more and more, they are diverting funds that should and otherwise would have gone into real asset investment. Now, it's real asset investment that creates jobs and therefore income and therefore consumption for the rest of us. You know, we don't get jobs from businesses investing in derivatives. We get jobs from them investing in making things. And they're making less and less or using less and less of us to make them. And they are investing more and more in businesses and markets where there is no real job creation going on. Okay, but listen, you know, we got this big hype here coming out even today about another 250,000 jobs have been created. And that's been going on for some time. And we have 3 million jobs, the best job creation in the U.S. since 1999, going on. That's a sign of a great recovery. Well, look at the composition of those jobs. First of all, they are very low-paid jobs. Many of them are what's called contingent part-time jobs. At the same time, we have an equal number of people leaving the labor force because they either can't find jobs or they can't survive on those low-paid jobs. Yes, we have a big churn in the labor force going on. As many people are not coming into the labor market or leaving the labor market as those who are getting low-paid jobs. So that's why wages aren't growing, one of the reasons why, and why we don't have income growth, and therefore we don't have real consumption, except for people borrowing, debt-based consumer spending going on, particularly for the bottom 60-70%. You know, maybe the top 20-30% are doing okay, spending based on income, particularly if a lot of their income comes from stocks and bonds, which have increased significantly in value and wealth and stimulated the high-end consumption. So we got high-end consumption and we got mid and low-end debt-based consumption going on, like auto loans, subprime loans, and so forth, right? That's not healthy. That's not sustainable in the long run. What we have are this growth towards contingent labor. That's another global trend going on, not just in the U.S., but everywhere. Everywhere businesses, capitalists are hiring people on a part-time temp basis more and more. If you look at Europe in the last 5 years, just about every major country in Europe, to the extent that they have hired people, 50, 60, 70% of the hires have been part-time contingent work. Even in Germany, vaulted German growth and so forth, 56% of the hires have been contingent. In Italy, it's 70%. Spain, the same thing. We have major changes going on in the labor markets in the world. All the capitalists have realized, hey, you know, we can only hire people part-time temp, don't pay them benefits, get away with it. Because they are so desperate for any kind of jobs, because we aren't creating real jobs, because we aren't really investing in real assets. And by the way, to the extent they are investing in real assets, quote, bringing home the jobs to the U.S., you hear, well, they create some jobs, but it's a good excuse for investing in new technology and automation and so forth. So we don't really hire as many jobs when they bring the business back. All right. So we have big changes globally going on in the labor markets. We have chronic high unemployment. And we have what's called falling labor force participation rates, people dropping out of the labor force. Oh, but wait a minute. Unemployment has been coming down in the U.S. Okay, yeah, well, it's coming down not so much because we have an increase in job hiring, but because people are dropping out of the labor force. You see, there's this technicality on how you calculate unemployment. If the size of the labor force drops, if people are leaving the labor force and the labor force participation rate has dropped about 5% since the crisis, it's down low 60s, it was high 60s when we began, if that happens, the unemployment rate goes down. In other words, unemployment rate can go down two reasons. One, because you're adding jobs. One, because people are dropping out of the labor force, because the unemployment rate is a function of jobs as a percent of the labor force. So is unemployment going down because we're really adding jobs, or is it going down more because people are dropping out? And if people are dropping out, is that a sign that there's really a robust labor market out there, that recovery is really going on? No, it isn't. There's some big problems in the labor force and in labor markets. They're being restructured globally by the capitalists. You know, they're moving more to just part-time temp jobs and getting rid of all these benefits and paying people pittances and let them go get two of these low-paid jobs if they want. That's the major trend. And, of course, it has a lot to do with why wages are declining, real wages declining. And if real wages decline, then you don't have income growth and you don't have real consumption. Therefore, people have to turn to debt to maintain their standard of living in order to finance consumption. All these things are interrelated, you see. And by the way, the outcome of this is, I described as growing income inequality. As wages decline and we have chronic people out of the labor force not making any money, if you look at how have wages performed on a class basis, you know, not just what's reported for full-time workers in the government statistics, what are their wage changes, which are declining even there, but if you take the loss of total wages for people who are dropping out and the decline in wages for part-timers, which aren't included in the wage calculations, you get even a deeper decline in wages going on in the U.S. than is reported. And, of course, that's because of the changes in the labor market that are going on. And no real increases in minimum wage, and the decline of unions, so they can't bring up union wage differentials, and free trade, which drives down average wages as well. All of these factors are real factors going on. Now, you know, economists like to talk about income inequality recently. Well, income inequality is what I've just described, a function of two things. One, a lack of growth or declining wages and incomes for the working classes, and also rising incomes that come from capital gains for, you know, the capital classes. You know, stock and bond sales and rents and interest and so forth, you know. Those who make their living, the 1%, wealthiest 1%, they don't make it by working. Most of them, they make it by investing. And they've been doing great. You know, profits have more than doubled since the bottom of the 2009 end of the recession, so-called. Bond returns have shot up to record levels. Who knows how much they're making on derivative trades because it's not reported. You know, all of these real estate, speculation and finance and so forth, they're making money hand over fist. And they're doing quite well, while the rest of us are languishing, stagnating, or declining in terms of wages and income. That's a major trend as well. And it explains why we can't get consumption going except debt-based for most of the population. And that's not just in the U.S. That's a trend everywhere. So when you got rising incomes, capital incomes, for the 10%, 1% especially, and you got stagnant and or declining real incomes for the rest, you got income inequality. In other words, income inequality trends are a function of two developments: rising income for the rich, stagnant declining income for the rest. Either way, right? Now, both are happening at the same time. That's why income inequality and the gap in it is growing so fast and so large. You know, if you look at statistics here, studies that have been done at the University of California, Berkeley, by professors Emmanuel Saez, it's very clear that since 2009, 95% of all the additional gains in income since 2009 have accrued to the 1%. Wow, that's worth repeating. 95% of all net income gains has gone to the 1% in the U.S. Income inequality. But again, it's because of financial asset profits, on the one hand, growing, and because of wages stagnating. And wages stagnating for, or declining for, various reasons that I talked about: the shift to contingent labor, the destruction of unions, free trade, et cetera, et cetera. Now, economists have discovered income inequality in recent years. You know, liberal economists in particular, Paul Krugman and George Stiglitz, Robert Reich, they're all writing these books, you know, based on Emmanuel Saez's data that he's been gathering since 2002. Yeah, that's when Saez began talking about this. And I used some of his data in my 2005 book called The War at Home, The Corporate Offensive from Reagan to Bush, identifying the policies that have brought about this income shift. You see, economists like Krugman and others like to talk about identifying the aggregate data showing the income inequality, but they don't explain it. They've discovered it, but they don't explain it. Oh, you know, they may say, oh, it's the income tax system, you know, tax cuts for the rich and not for the rest of us. Well, that's true, but the tax system is not a fundamental cause of the income inequality. It's an enabler of it. In other words, the fundamental cause is where the income is generated and how it's generated, even before it hits the tax system. You know, the income is reduced and slowed for the working classes in ways I've described, and for increase for the wealthy classes, financialization and financial profits and capital gains, right, that I've described. But then those big gains for the rich from financial speculation and corporate profits, the tax system allows them to keep more of it. That's the role of the tax system. You know, the tax system passes through, allows more to pass through to the rich when you reduce taxes for them. And that's, of course, been going on for some time now, reduction in taxes, income taxes, estate taxes, dividends, and so forth for the rich. More has been passed through. You see, the corporation is the conduit for the creation and passage of income. Who does it go to? If the corporation reduces the wage cost, then that means there's more that goes into profits and can be distributed by Apple, you know, $50 billion distributed to their shareholders, and they're all distributing tens and hundreds of billions of dollars to their shareholders. Look, last year, how much in corporate buybacks of their stock? Well, that's a direct distribution, isn't it? If I buy back my stock, I'm paying directly money to my shareholders. Right? How much did U.S. corporations buy back last year? Interesting. Oh, somewhere between $350 and $500 billion. How much did they pay out in dividends? Oh, another $300, $400 billion. That's in 1 year. In other words, it's close to $1 trillion that they pass through to their shareholders, most of which, of course, goes to wealthy, and it's all the 10%, especially the 1%, wealthiest households that get this benefit. $1 trillion passed through, and they're still sitting on $2 trillion, most of it stuffed in their offshore subsidiaries. As I said before, they borrow the money at very low rates, much of it, to then pass through. But the tax system allows them to pass this through to their wealthy shareholders. Okay, and of course, that gets recorded as a rise in income inequality. But it's the corporation. It's fundamental. Where is income generated? That must be the source of explanation of why we have income inequality. And you know, my problem with liberal economists is that they identify inequality, they report it, but they don't explain it. Maybe they say the tax system. Well, that's easy to say, because then you don't have to go after your corporate friends to say, you know, it's not just the politicians and tax cuts for corporations and the rich. It's even more fundamental. And if you go after the corporations as the source of this, i.e. financial speculation more and repressing and compressing wages more. If you go after them, then who are you going after? Well, you're going after the big contributors to your political friends. And so your political friends come and knock on the door of Paul and say, hey, Paul, don't, you're going too far here. Talk about the tax system and blame the politicians, but don't go after our corporate benefactors. We don't want people to think that there's a class system here and class exploitation going on. You know, so Paul sort of, he cushions his critique, he talks about, to taxes. And the same with, Reich and others. Because they're all Democrats, right? And they all write on behalf of the left wing of the Democratic Party, but the Democratic Party is funded by corporations now. more than ever before. So don't get too deep into this effort to explain inequality. You know, and then we have this book by Thomas Piketty, right? That's the big rage of liberals, and particularly you know, the Krugmans and others. You know, Thomas Piketty talks about the quote. His book is called Capital. Well, it's not about capital. It's about income inequality. It's the same data that Sayers had developed 10, 12 years ago, that Sayers has continued to develop. In fact, Piketty was a colleague working on this back in the early 2000s with Emmanuel Sayers. Sayers isn't getting enough attention for this very yeoman important work that he's done, but Piketty is. Hmm? But Piketty, like the others, you know, focuses largely on the surface causes, in other words, the tax system. Or maybe he talks about the you know, ridiculous CEO pay that's been running you know, through the roof here. CEOs have been rewarding themselves nicely for some time. CEO total compensation as a percent has risen significantly in the last 10 years. So, you know, you can talk about the CEOs maybe, and you can talk about the tax system and politicians, but don't get down there to talk about, you know, what are the labor market wage strategies of these corporations? Because if you look at much of the profit growth, which has far exceeded already the peak before the recession, if you look at that profit growth, let's just take the U.S., much of that profit growth is not because they're selling more stuff at a higher price, which isn't the case. It's because they've been cutting costs. In other words, that profit growth is at the direct expense of the workers. It's what we call margin profit, operating margins profit, or profit margins, as they say. You know, not absolute level profit revenue growth, which really shows that, you know, this big growth has been at the expense largely of the workers who work for these corporations, i.e. now we got more people working part-time, temp, right? And now we're, corporations are getting rid of paying benefits, right? Look, that's what all this ACA, Obamacare, is about, so corporations can get out of the business of providing health care benefits for their workers. And by 2018, that door's going to slam shut, because the ACA bill will tax most union-provided health care plans with 40% tax. That's the end of union-negotiated health care plans. At the same time, they've been gouging and chipping away at real benefits, pension benefits. And just recently, Congress voted to cut, encourage employers to cut multi-employer pension plans. I'm talking about real pensions, defined benefit pensions. Right, these plans, you know, are a little underwater because the employers are not putting money into them, or they're withdrawing from the multi-employer plans like UPS, and that puts pressure on them. But the pressure is still 15 years away. They still got enough money, but Congress, nonetheless, recently passed a measure that said, "Well, you know, employers don't have to put any money in these plans. Start cutting benefits." Yeah. In other words, they want to get rid of real pension plans. They want everybody to get into these phony 401ks, which the banks can make money off of, right? And which you can lose your pants. And employers don't have to provide money into these pension plans, 401ks. They can. They might not. You know, some do, some don't. In other words, there's no liability there for them, and the cost is optional to them. So they're getting rid of employer-negotiated union plans. They're getting rid of pension plans. Right? This is all part of what's going on at the labor market, the ground level, and they're hiring more and more part-time people and the contingent labor and so forth, and low pay, et cetera. All this is driving down wages. And, of course, that means big profits. And then we pass it through a nice tax system that allows us to, and it goes to our friends, and that creates income inequality. You see, in my 2006 book, The War at Home, I attempted to identify what were the policies and changes from 1980, when this thing really began to accelerate under Reagan, up to 2005 that are responsible for this income inequality. In other words, let's not just talk about the aggregate data fact. Let's look at the policies and the changes in labor markets and other government policies, like free trade and so forth, that are causing this income inequality. Look at the real fundamental causes. Okay, so income inequality is a trend. Growing debt is a trend. Deflation, disinflation is a trend. Declining real investment, real asset investment that creates jobs is a trend. All of these are trends, right? And we're even now talking about labor market reforms and other forms of austerity, particularly in Europe and elsewhere, right? This is all about let's go after our labor force and extract even more from them. That's what the austerity is in the first place. And now labor market reforms are an extension of that. I already mentioned now in Europe how 70% of all the hires have been part-time temporary. On top of that, they've been cutting government spending and programs for average folks and so forth, and selling off national assets. You know, this is all, quote, austerity. And then, of course, hiring all the part-timers, that's austerity. And now they want to go after even people with full-time jobs in Europe. They call that labor market restructuring reforms. And that's becoming a hot issue everywhere, you know, from Europe to India. You know, the capitalists and their politicians are saying, well, we need to restructure labor markets. You know, that's a code word for how can we squeeze even more out of them. Okay, so that's a trend. Another trend is the growth and expansion of shadow banks. I've been writing about that some here for Telesur in my weekly articles for Telesur, some of which are on my blog, jackrasmus.com, and our website, Kyklos Productions, kyklosproductions.com. You can read those articles. Looking at what's happening with the growth of shadow banks. You know, shadow banks have been destabilizing. Well, first of all, who are shadow bankers? Well, shadow bankers are the unregulated side of the global banking system. Well, what are we talking about? Well, we're talking about hedge funds, private equity firms, asset management companies, boutique banks, insurance companies, on and on and on. This has been the rapid growth in the finance banking system, totally unregulated. And what do these shadow banks do? Well, they invest the money of their very, very wealthy investors. What are called ultra-high net worth investors. There's about 200,000 of them in the world, and their investments generate, on average, $20 million a year in net new income. That means they got billions probably in assets that generate that, but, you know, 20 million more in income every year on average for the 200,000. Okay, so these are the finance capital elite, the new finance capital elite of the world, and they keep their money largely in these shadow banks, and the shadow banks invested on their behalf, private equity, you know, hedge funds and so forth, all around the world. Now, the commercial banking system has gotten into this game, too. That's where this financial deregulation comes in. It comes in because the commercial banks say, hey, we want a piece of that nice pie. And ever since the 80s, they've been getting themselves deregulated so they can act like shadow banks, too, and engage and invest in these very high risky but high return opportunities in these in derivatives markets and so forth. And, of course, when we have a financial crash, these banks are pulled down. So there's a blurring between the shadow banks and the regulated commercial banks. They're both playing the same game. And, as I said earlier, we even have a blurring with non-financial multinational corporations who increasingly invest a quarter or a third of their revenue returns come from financial investments. Financial asset investments, portfolio investment, as they call it. We might call them the shadow banks, right? Growing. So this big trend towards financial asset investment is undeniable throughout the world, and it is also accelerating as well. Now, the problem is, as this part of the global financial system grows, and now it is estimated somewhere around $75 trillion of investable short-term assets in these shadow banks and the markets they invest in. You know, they invest in stock markets and bond markets and real estate and foreign exchange trading in derivatives of all kinds. You know, this is where all this money goes, goes in, goes out, takes advantage of price appreciation, takes the profits, jumps and goes to another market overnight. These monies move around. In moving around, sometimes they move into markets and boost the price too much, and you get a bubble. And then bubbles, of course, bust. And if the bubble, the price bubble busts, and you got participation in it by regulated commercial banks or other government, local governments and so forth, then the bust pulls down the regulated banks and the local governments as well. And we have a real estate housing crisis, you know, or we have a commercial property crisis, like we did a few years ago, or we have a junk bond crisis, which is coming, right? All of these things, this shift, in other words, towards financial asset investment is causing instability in the global financial system. Instability. And every time you have a crash, it gets harder for the regulated financial institutions to recover. We see this clearly in Europe. The banks cannot recover. If banks can't recover, they don't make loans to real businesses. If you don't get real businesses borrowing, like in Europe, heavily dependent on bank loans there, you don't get a recovery. And that's why Europe is in its third recession, bouncing along the bottom. Okay, so this trend of towards larger and larger and a bigger share of the global financial markets by shadow banks and their ultra-high net worth investors is another important global trend going on. And it's a destabilizing trend. And we're going to see another financial crash here before the end of this decade, no doubt. Okay. So we've identified a whole host of trends here so far. Just to sum up some of them, slowing global economic growth, slowing of the rate of growth in real asset physical investment as a percent of total investment, a rise in financial asset investment, and the two, of course, are directly inversely related to each other. We have disinflation and drift towards deflation going on. We have a growing increase in debt, private sector in particular. Well, I didn't mention, if you read the Bank of International Settlements recent report earlier this year, that's located in Geneva. It's kind of the bank of the central banks, and they do a lot of research, and they've identified this data on rising global debt, and what they've identified is that biggest rise is in the private sector debt, and most of that's in business debt. Once again, the same thing then happened in the build-up to the 2008-09 crash. Most of that debt increase was private debt. It wasn't government debt. Government debt increase comes after the crash when the government attempts to bail out the rest, bail out the financial system, bail out the banks. You know, bail out the big corporations. And that's what happened in 2008-09. And government debt, of course, rises because you have a deep economic contraction and tax revenues fall at the same time. And you have to pay more unemployment insurance and so forth. All that adds to government debt. But that comes after. Government balance sheet debt rises faster after a crash than it does before the crash. Before the crash, it's private sector debt. And that private sector debt is business debt, as I described, as businesses borrow more and more to speculate in financial assets. And, by the way, at the same time, we have the phenomenon of consumer households borrowing more and more because their wages aren't rising. So we have two forms of private debt, household debt, and business debt, both of which rise. The household debt rises chronically and consistently because of no wage growth. And the business debt arises because of borrowing junk bonds and so forth, take advantage of speculation and quick profits in financial asset investment. And then government debt, of course, cuts taxes on businesses to let them have more to speculate with. And at the same time, then the crash comes and the government has to bail everybody out. So its debt rises. And it's the interrelationship of these three forms of debt, I think, that are crucial here. Private, household, business, and government debt. And the lack of income growth to service that debt. You know, the debt and the income growth are something I call fragility. Not an original term to me, but the idea of systemic fragility is the growing trend of greatest importance in the global economy. Systemic fragility meaning business fragility and debt, household fragility and government balance sheet fragility and debt. And by the way, that's the topic of my next book coming out this spring, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. We'll be talking more about that in future weeks here, but this is just an overview of the major global trends going on today, are of great import. And next week we will come back and return and talk about Europe, the Eurozone. You know, we've talked about China and Japan and emerging markets, and we'll talk about the Eurozone, the other major pole in the global economy, and then we should have data by the end of the month to talk about the U.S. in more detail. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.